Luke 18, starting in verses 9 through 10. If you need to grab a coffee or snack or whatever, go ahead. I'll begin by reading the first two verses from a passage, Luke 18, 9 through 10. It says, Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. So we have this parable that Jesus is going to tell us that begins with two men going to the temple to pray, to converse with God, to meet with God, to be in the presence of God. Before we get into that, we need to understand that undergirding this parable is the presence of some cosmic law, some standard of morality or righteousness that governs the created world. Because what's the purpose of trying to be righteous if there is no need to be righteous? If there's no reason to be righteous, no law to attain to, why even do it in the first place? Obviously, as Christians, we would say that the God of the Bible is the one who has given law, given rule to the created order, by virtue of his status as the one who has created all things out of nothing. He has the authority and responsibility to set the operating standards, if you will, for his dominion. Just as an inventor has the authority and responsibility to set forth how his invention will operate, just as the entrepreneur who starts a business has the authority and responsibility to set forth the operations manual for his business, so also the one who creates the world gets the authority and responsibility to set forth the standards, the righteousness of how that world ought to operate, how people ought to live within that creation. Some would contend that no God exists. God would disagree with them. Psalm 14:1a, first part of verse 1, says that the fool says in his heart, there is no God. I don't think this is talking about modern philosophical atheism. The one who says in his heart, there is no God, and lives as though there's no God in terms of the authority of the world. There's no God, there's no authority that can tell me how I ought to live. That person is a fool. Consider the consequences of atheism or believing that there is no God, which there are many. But one consequence of primary concern is righteousness. If there is no God, who gets to establish moral authority? Who gets to establish what is right and wrong? Is it you? Is it me? Is it them? Is it they? Who gets it? Is it the president of this country or the dictator of that country? Who gets to decide what the standard for righteousness is? I mean, think about this. You go back to the example of an entrepreneur who starts a business. How foolish would it be for him to start his business and then say, well, I really have no principles, I have no rules, I have no guidelines for how this business is going to operate. I'm just going to hire 100 people, and y'all just decide what is right for you. How well will that business function? It will not function. It will be chaos, and it will no longer be a business after about 3 minutes. There's a quartet of philosophers, at least one has passed away now. Anyways, they're called the four horsemen of atheism, a play on the four horsemen of the apocalypse and whatever. But any modern discussion of atheism basically goes through these four guys, and I've read a number of their books, and one, they have all sorts of ridiculous complaints about Christianity. One is that they look at the book of Judges. If you're familiar with the book of Judges lays out quite a few accounts and stories of every manner of depravity, anything that you can think of that would be wicked, it's done by the people in the stories of Judges. And they conclude, based on hearing that this book is in the Bible or in the Christian canon, or because these things were done by the people, Israelites, who said they were the people of God, that somehow these were God's sanctioned events, as though God was the one who wanted these things to happen. What they don't realize is that it's the exact opposite. The point of Judges is the exact opposite. The very last sentence in the book of Judges says this: everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That is the consequence of there being no God. If you want to look like, if you want to see what the world will look like for those who do not believe in God, just read the book of Judges, and you will see it play out. You see it play out in the world before us. This is no different, really, than the book of Judges, actually. You leave it to creation to decide its own rule of righteousness. There will be no standard for righteousness. You'll end with a, I don't know if any of you, they still read this in schools, or if you read it when you were in school, The Lord of the Flies. Leave people without a standard of moral authority, and it will quickly descend into anarchy. Thankfully, there is a God, and he is good, he is just, he has set forth a good standard of righteousness. Revelation 16:7. Yes, Lord God the Almighty, true and just are your judgments. So concluding that the God of the Bible exists and he is the Almighty, how does one live up to this standard of righteousness? How does one operate within this realm that God has created? And it's fairly clear that when you actually consider what God has required, that it is impossible for humanity to live up to that standard. Two of my go-to verses for this in the Old Testament, these aren't the only two by far. There's plenty of verses and whole passages that would show this, but Isaiah 64:6, we have all become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous deeds are like a polluted garment. We all fade like a leaf. Our iniquities, like the wind, take us away. The collective goodness of humanity is still putrid in the sight of God compared to how holy and righteous and good he is. Psalm 14:1. They are corrupt. This is part B for those who believe there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is no one who does good. Now this creates a problem. If the collective employees of the entrepreneur, he starts his business, he hires his 100 employees, he's got his standards. If the collective employees do not follow the operating procedures, the standards set forth by this entrepreneur, what happens? Do they just keep on being employed by the employer, or do they get fired? Depending on the things that they're breaking, maybe they even go to prison for breaking some kind of rules. But if you have an employer who sets out his standards and you don't follow them in any way, what happens? There's consequences. If you have an inventor who creates a machine, he says, this is how it operates, and nobody operates the machine like it's supposed to be operated, what happens? Failure of some sort. If you have somebody who creates a car and nobody knows how to drive the car, and they just say, hey, just, I don't know, do whatever. You can drive it however you want. Just go drive that car however you want. Don't have any regard for the rules. What will happen? It should have been clear to the people in that day of Jesus, that humanity cannot meet the standard of God's righteousness. And if such a truth was clear, it ought to have set them on a search to find out how they could do that. If I look and I say, okay, I cannot This is what I know my employer wants of me. I can't do that. And if I want to stay employed, I have the responsibility to go forth and say, okay, I need to figure out how I can meet the standards of this employer. Otherwise, I'm going to be fired. I've got to figure this out. Somebody show me, give me some help as to how I can meet these standards. That's the way it ought to be with human beings. Well, okay, there's this God, and he's created the world, and he's far beyond who I am. I'm just a little created being. I better figure out. How to operate within the standards of God's righteousness. And yet here is Jesus addressing people who trusted in themselves that they met God's standards of righteousness. God laid forth the standard, and these people were just like, I got my own standard, and I'm good to go. Notice before we continue on, the result of self-righteousness. In verse 9, it had said that they treated others with contempt. Contempt, disdain or derision. Contempt means to not give value or worth to anything. Contempt despises people. At some point, if you live self-righteously, it will result in contempt for others. Doesn't mean that you'll have contempt for every person at every time, but self-righteousness will always create contempt for other people. So what is this self-righteousness? Essentially, self-righteousness is believing that one can achieve God's own righteousness within one's own self because of one's own goodness, because of the things that one does. And we see how we can identify it. The first of the two men, the Pharisee, in Luke 11, 18, 11, and 12, the next two verses. So there's two men. The first is a Pharisee standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. If you consider the actions of the Pharisee, he's standing by himself. The idea here is that everything he's doing is unto himself. And so some translations even say he's praying to himself. He's not really praying to God. He's just talking to himself for his own sake. There's a Latin word for this called incurvatus, means curved inwards. The heart, the self, is curved inwards on oneself. It has no consideration for anything around them. They're an island unto themselves. I guess if you want to put it in the form, I've got three signposts, if we could call it that. How to see that self-righteousness is present or just around the corner. Self-righteousness lives unto itself. Self-righteous people live unto themselves. Self-righteous people repel others out of a sense of arrogant superiority. Self-righteous people believe that they are the standard of righteousness. And so they tend to push out people who doesn't match with their standard. And they do this, I believe, in part because self-righteous people don't want a mirror reflecting back into their own lives. If you want a good gauge of how righteous your heart really is, interact with sinful people. You cannot ascertain how righteous your own heart is when you're asleep. But you can when sinful people press against you. When sinful people do things that offend you, that hurt you, see how your heart reacts and see how much righteousness starts coming out then. I believe that this is actually one of the reasons for Christian marriage and Christian community. God gives you a spouse in part. God gives you a church community in part as a mirror into your own life. These relationships are a primary means by which God accomplishes his holiness in you. And if we understood this, we would have a much better Christian experience in our church communities and in our marriages. Because we often look at other people to make us happy. And so when they do things that don't make us happy, we get angry at them. But if we understood that God cares more about your holiness and your righteousness than he does his happiness, you would be better off for it. Because here's the deal. True happiness and joy only comes in righteousness. And we begin to look at other people, and when they detract from our happiness, when they do things that offend us, we tend to get angry. Our righteousness is coming out. And God gives us people as a mirror. He places them in front of us as a mirror so we can truly see what is coming out of our hearts, coming out of our mouths, coming out of our actions. If you want a good marriage, not an easy marriage, if you want a good marriage, if you want a good Christian experience, not an easy Christian experience in community, believe that you are the greater sinner. And believe that your spouse and your friends or your Christian community is not there to be your servant. They're not there to... Too often Christians look to people to satisfy them in ways that only God is meant to. Human beings aren't meant to satisfy your loneliness. God gives us these things as good gifts to enjoy, but do not put people in the place of God. If you do, you will be vastly disappointed because people will fail you, and if you're trusting in them to not fail you, you will always be frustrated at people. If you believe that your spouse is there as a primary means by which God, if we believe that holiness is good, Hebrews 12, 19, somewhere around there, 14, says that peace, true peace, only comes in righteousness. Who wants peace? Anybody want true peace? The holistic, the shalom peace, peace with people, peace in your heart, peace in your mind, peace with God, peace. Does anybody not want that? The only way to do that is to have righteousness, to be living in righteousness. And God gives us people, in part, to lead us in that way. And if you start thinking that way and looking at other people, thank you, Lord, for putting this person in my life to teach me righteousness rather than, why did you give this person to me? I'm so frustrated with them. Too often Christians live in self-righteous lives. They repel people because we're waiting for them to treat us right, to serve us. We're to be servants of others. Believe that God has put the people in your life for your joy, for your good. And believe that you're the greater sinner. If you're not interacting with people who are pressing into your life and pushing you and pressing down, I would say you're not truly living in Christian community. If you have nobody in your life that's not frustrating you in some way to really act as that mirror, you're not truly living in Christian community. Self-righteousness lives unto itself for its own sake. It doesn't want to truly be known because then its self-righteousness will come out. And self-righteousness doesn't really want to get to know others because you're self-righteous. Why would you need anyone else? Signpost 2, self-righteous people parade their good works for the approval of God and man. Consider the prayer of the Pharisee. God, look what I've done. Oh, God, if you could just see how amazing I am. Surely, proclaiming it loudly for all people to hear, as we know the Pharisees were wont to do, they liked to have their prayers heard because they always prayed about what they had done. Self-righteousness always involves contrast. If you set your own standard for righteousness, you will need a comparison in order to keep your own standard going. So we have here the Pharisee, self-righteousness. righteously exalting himself and denigrating the other person to create this image of contrast. God, look at me, that person. This is why self-righteous people often say, I would never do that. They're drawing a comparison. I'm not the type of person that would do those things. I'm the type of person that does these things. If you're not the type of person that would do that, what would you do? Paul says in Romans 2:1, therefore you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself because you, the judge, practice the very same things. Maybe it's not the literally exact same things, but the sin, the root of it, it's the same things. And if you're a person who does not do that or has not done that, it's not because you have some amazing righteousness, and it's not because you would never do it. Put yourself in that person's shoes with their experiences, their mindset. I bet you would have done it. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:10, by the grace of God, I am what I am. If you are the way you are, living in some sort of righteousness, it's not because of your own righteousness. It's because of the grace of God. Another way you might hear self-righteousness being prayed is when people say, what that person did was unforgivable. Really? By whose standard? Your standard? Like you're the standard of what ought to be forgiven and what can't be forgiven? Like whose standard are you going by? You just randomly picked some things out of thin air and said, well, that can't be forgiven. Of course, my sins can be forgiven because I haven't sinned by that guy. Self-righteousness. If you hear those things, if you said those things, be very careful. This leads to a third marker of self-righteousness that I think we see here in the Pharisee's prayer. Self-righteous people are uncompassionate. I'm not even actually sure if that's a word, uncompassionate. At least they have no compassion to the burdens of others. We don't see it explicitly in the Pharisee's prayer, but I think it's implied in his comparison to these other men. Self-righteous people don't consider life from someone else's perspective. They don't consider the burdens that another person bears. In a similar passage in Matthew talking about the Pharisees, Jesus says, Matthew 23:4, they tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. The Pharisees were quick to burden people with all sorts of things, but they wouldn't even so much as help that person with a single finger. And a single finger, you can't even do much of anything with a single finger. Point is that the Pharisees literally had no compassion, none, for the burdens of people. You consider this contrast to the life of a Christian. And Paul says in Galatians 6, 2 and 3, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. If you're not bearing another's burdens, you're not fulfilling the law of Christ. And Paul, if you go into Galatians, Paul's not talking about, oh, I just had a really tough day at work. I've got this heavy burden. I'm wrestling through this death of a friend. I've got this heavy burden. He's talking about sin, people who are living in sin. Christians are to bear, not engage in that same sin, but bear with one another in their burdens. Not that we just let them go on sinning, but we to bear with them, to be compassionate towards their sin. Just because people are responsible for their own sin, which they are, just because someone might be suffering the consequences of their sin, which we do, does not mean that we should not be unmerciful or uncompassionate to people under the burden of sin. I'm amazed at how often I hear this phrase come nonchalantly from people in the church, not this particular church, but in the church in general. Nah, they got what they deserved. Isn't God's forgiveness and his mercy about sinners not getting what they deserved? How can we go on saying, well, they got what they deserved? Matt, you know, if you live in sin like that, that's what's going to happen. Well, yes, it is. But if God has been merciful to us, we have a responsibility to be merciful and compassionate to others. So there's the Pharisee, standing alone, exalting his own works, denigrating others, exalting his own self-righteousness. And then we have the tax collector, the other man in this parable. In verse 13 it says, but the tax collector, standing far off, not near with the people near to God, standing far off, is in a different way than the Pharisee standing by himself. This tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. This tax collector's tax collection profession was a despised profession by the Jews. He has absolutely no claim of righteousness before God. He has no claim of worthiness. He knows his unworthiness to the extent that he won't even lift his eyes to heaven. He doesn't presume upon God. He knows he doesn't belong there. He's not even keen to lift his eyes to the dwelling place of God. God, I don't even deserve to look up and see it, much less enter it. His only claim is his unrighteousness. He is a sinner, or perhaps better stated, the New American Standard gets this, the sinner. The sinner. There's a definite article on that word sinner, and it probably should be the sinner. Not that he's the only sinner, but that he understands that he embodies everything that sin is. He's not just a sinner. I've done a little bit of sin, but everybody else is a sinner too, so it's fine. Don't worry about sin. Everybody's a sinner. No prob. He is the sinner. He is guilty of all the charges. Everything that is sin is him. He knows it. As a sinner, he has nothing of his own righteousness to offer to God. What's he going to say? Hey, God, look at this. God, I'm guilty. I got nothing. There is nothing that I can give you. He understands how wholly and thoroughly he falls short of God's righteousness. He understands it doesn't even matter how much he would try. He would still fall short, so he doesn't even try. So what option is there? He falls short. He knows it. The Pharisee, self-righteousness is not a real good option. What option is there? Entrust yourself to God's mercy. Be merciful to me, God. That's my only option. That's my only hope. Entrust yourself to the character of God. That's the only way this salvation thing will work out for you. And this was actually nothing new. This is not like a New Testament thing. It's not like Jesus came around and started showing us this deal. I really don't like the words Old Testament and New Testament. It's one Testament. This is Psalm 51. Here's David's prayer. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love, according to your abundant mercy. David's only claim was in God's character. God, I got nothing. If you don't come through according to your character, I'm in big trouble. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. I know my transgression. My sin is ever before me. David did not hide his sin. He didn't try to make it to be smaller than it was. And David placed himself at the mercy of God. The tax collector placed himself at the mercy of God. Really, this is like a courtroom scene. It's not literally a courtroom scene because they're in the temple in the parable. But that's the idea behind it. The Pharisees... The tax collector knows he's guilty in the court of law. He's got charges against him. He knows he's guilty. There's proof. There's evidence. There's witnesses. We've got God. Others can witness your own unrighteousness, surely. But God, being the triune God, three persons in one, is enough witnesses to establish your guilt. So this guy, he's guilty. He's in the courtroom. He knows he's guilty. He knows he deserves all the full punishment They're going to give him. He's not going to make any excuses. It doesn't really, is a murderer going to death row isn't going to say, yeah, but, you know, like, seriously, 5 years ago, I went with my brother and we served a meal at the food pantry, so maybe you could take that into account when you're sentencing. The judge is going to be like, okay, you murdered somebody, so, you know, sorry, death penalty. There's no excuses to be made. His only hope is whether the judge is merciful, whether the judge is compassionate, whether the judge will look at that person's life and say, I understand the hardships of being a sinner and I will be merciful to it. Look at the outcome. So there's two people. And the question is here, which one will attain to God's righteousness? Which one will actually enter in and be a citizen living in the universe according to God's standards? Is it going to be the self-righteous Pharisee? Is it going to be the sinner asking for mercy? Last verse of our passage, verse 14. I tell you, this man, the tax collector, went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Justified means to be made righteous. In Greek, most of your versions, if it says righteous or justified, it's the same root word in Greek, just a different form. Justified literally means to be made righteous, or the root behind it is to be vindicated in a court of law, to be cleared of all charges. That's what the word means, to be justified. You've been vindicated in the court of law. You're clear of all charges. How did that come to be? And it wasn't the man with the religious pedigree who was justified, who found favor with God. It wasn't the man with a long list of accomplishments who was justified, who found favor with God. It wasn't the man with the honorable title that was justified, that found favor with God. It wasn't the man with his laundry list of good deeds, an overdoer of the law, who was justified. It was the man who was guilty who was justified. It was the sinner who was justified. And consider the gravity of that verse. The only people who are justified, who are found not guilty in the sight of God, who attain to the righteousness of God, are those who know they are unrighteous, who don't deserve to be justified, and willingly acknowledge that unrighteousness first to themselves and then to God. I mean, you're not going to acknowledge it to God if you don't acknowledge it to yourself first. The only people who will be cleared by God, who will be justified, made righteous, vindicated in God's courtroom, are those people who know they don't deserve to be cleared, who are guilty, who are the sinner, and are willing to relinquish their eternal fate to the merciful judge. Okay, God, there's a day of judgment coming in Jesus Christ. You're going to judge the world just as you ought to do, because anybody who says they're good and righteous but doesn't judge wickedness is not a good God. So there's this day of judgment coming. God's going to say, okay, righteous, unrighteous. The only person who will actually be declared not guilty are those who say, okay, God, this day of judgment is coming and I got nothing. So you're going to have to be merciful to me. That's my only hope. It's not a demand, God, do this for me. But God, that's my only hope. That's faith in the mercy of God. 1 Timothy 1:15, Paul says, this saying is trustworthy and deserving of full acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the foremost. Who does Jesus save? Who does Jesus save? Sinners. That's the only type of person Jesus saves, sinners. Anybody a sinner here? That's the only type of person Jesus saves. If you're a sinner, if you've done a lot of bad things, you're actually in a really good place, because that is the only type of person Jesus saves. How does Jesus save them? By their own good works? By coming down and saying, well, got to pick out my favorites here. I really got a thing against that kind of sin, so you're out. That sin kind of really disgusts me, so we'll just exclude those people. looking for somebody that's a little more righteous. Ephesians 2, 8, and 9. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast. If you have room to boast in your salvation, you're not thinking about salvation rightly. You ought to not be able to say, I deserve this, I did this. You ought to be saying, nothing about what God is giving me in his love and mercy is deserved. As sometimes I've said before, don't start with everything you think you ought to have and then subtract what you don't have and be bitter about it. Start with literally nothing and start adding everything you do have, and you'll start to be able to see better what God's love and mercy looks like. Because of God's own good favor towards sinners, and by faith, believing, you must believe it and entrust yourself and go into that courtroom. Like if you're going to jump bail and say, God, I'm not going in there. You have to believe by faith that you can walk in that courtroom and say, okay, God, I'm guilty. My only hope is your mercy. How could this be? How can God do this? How can God justify the guilty? 2 Corinthians 5:21. For our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. We could write a whole book on that verse. But let me just draw one thing out. Consider the gods. I don't know if any of you have done any research into Greek mythology, Roman mythology, or any other gods, human inventions. The gods are literally crazy. The gods are crazy. Like any god that humanity has invented is crazy. Capricious, they're malevolent, they're psychopathic, they're envious, they're greedy, they're gluttonous, they're rapacious. Like if you're not going to believe in the Christian God, you better be pretty confident what you're believing in. Or if you just say, God doesn't exist, well, you better be pretty confident of that claim. The Christian God is so vastly different. The Christian God rules over the earth, comes down from his eternal throne, not like the other gods, malicious and just who knows how is this God going to act? I have no idea. I mean, the people who serve these false gods, they literally have no idea what their God is going to do. And so they spend their entire lives trying to appease the God. Oh, please, if I could just do this, if I just do this, maybe God will. They have no idea whether God will be happy with them or not. They have no idea. The Christian God comes down from his throne to earth, leaving all that glory to come down into sinful, depraved, wicked humanity to live among us, to serve us. Yeah, I'll get real messy with y'all. I'm going to come down and serve you. What? He comes down to save sinners, the worst of the people. Now, this is crazy. He doesn't come down to save the good guys. He comes down to save the bad guys. So that they can be saved and enjoy God's perfect righteousness and holiness and joy forever. He said, I'll give you everything. I'm going to give you everything. I mean, okay, I know I'm way underselling what God has done. I mean, I can't even wrap my mind around it, but that's mercy. That's grace. That's love. And it's not like anything else you will find in the universe, any other God or any other. I mean, atheism still basically is a religion because atheism just makes humanity its God. But you know, to the self-righteous, that is offensive that God would save the bad guys. Because the self-righteous people don't want God to save the bad guys. They want God to save the good guys because they think they are the good guys. Other people, the bad guys, and God, I don't want you to save them. You got to save me. But to sinners, to the bad guys, to the people who know they're the bad guys, this is good news. This is the gospel. The gospel means good news. This is the gospel of Jesus. This is the best possible news, at least for bad guys, for people who don't have any hope, who know they're sinners, who know they don't measure up to God's standard, who usually the bad guys don't even live up to the standard of humanity. Usually humanity, you're clearly the bad guys. You're the bad guys. You're the other people. You're they. You're those. You're like those people. Self-righteous people don't like the gospel because the gospel is offensive to self-righteous people, because the gospel means that good people are condemned and bad people are made righteous. Now, there's a whole other conversation of how we actually begin to live, once we enter in and actually begin to live out righteous. This does not mean that you go on just doing whatever you want and keep living wickedly, clearly. But the good news of the gospel is that the only qualification to enter into the salvation life, the Christian life, and to begin a life lived for God, for the joy, for the hope that God offers, the only qualification is that you have to be a sinner. That's it. God justifies sinners. God saves sinners. So if you are a sinner, you are in a good place, because you can call it to God and ask for his mercy. Lord God, I pray that your word, the true words, not the words that I spoke that miscommunicated what it was, but the true words of the good news of the gospel, that Jesus Christ would come down and die the death that we deserved on the cross, take our place of judgment in that courtroom and set us free. Lord, I pray that we would know the depths and the magnitude of our sin, and that we would entrust ourselves to your mercy. I pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Let's sing a couple songs.